Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Remember when some people thought America would be moving into a post-racial age because of the election of Barack Obama? If anything, just the opposite has actually happened. It seems like racism is even worse now. People are saying and doing things today that would have been unimaginable not that long ago. Racism is out in the open, but hasn't it always just been there? Now people aren't hiding it so much anymore. Was it naive to think, to hope, that we can achieve a colorblind society so easily? Well, what is holding us back, and how did we get here? We're joined by Dr. Ibram X. Kendi. He is the author of Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. He's a professor of African-American history at the University of Florida. And Dr. Kendi, welcome to The Source.
Pleasure to be there.
And there's lots of ways for folks to join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. You can also email questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at tprsource. So, Dr. Kendi, anything in my intro that you want to take me to task for?
No, I think you were dead on. I think many Americans, and not just white Americans, Americans of all races, really hoped that President Obama's election would bring upon a new day in race relations. People hoped that we would, of course, arrived in a post-racial society. But, of course, the constant killings of unarmed black people, the presidential campaign, a number of incidents have, of course, shown many fair thinking people that, you know, racism is still with us. And so I think, you know, my book actually sort of chronicles exactly where we came from. And I think it gives us some insight into how to sort of create an anti-racist sort of America.
And we'll work through that in just a bit. Is it fair to say that racism seems worse now than 8 years ago?
I think that that's actually been the debate among people who are interested in these topics, among scholars of race. And what I try to sort of show is the ways in which there has been racial progress. And I think there has actually been progress as it relates to race over the last 8 years, just like there's been racial progress over the course of American history. But then what we also have to reckon with is the fact that there's also been a progression of racism over the last 8 years, a progression of racism over the last over the course of American history, and I think it's difficult for people to sort of understand that we've simultaneously had both over the last 8 years, and I think you've had two sides arguing their side, racial progress, let's say progression of racism, and both sides believe that they were right, and in some ways they were.
Why is it so hard to move past racism? I mean, it seems the origins of racism is an antiquated idea. We have science now that shows us that there is no such thing as actual races. You know, we're all from Africa. We're all, of course, there's cultural and identity issues, but still to have this idea, and you talk about the definition of a racist idea is that someone thinks that another person is a race is inferior to them. Does that really seem to function anymore?
Yeah, I think one of my major findings in the book was really in Stamped from the Beginning was really trying to answer that question, and I assumed that Americans, that people who held these racist ideas, were ignorant and they needed to be educated. I also assumed that people were hateful and that we just had a hateful, sort of ignorant country that needed to practice more love and that needed to be educated. And what I sort of found over the course of history is that you had people who were constantly producing racist ideas, not necessarily because they were ignorant, not necessarily because they were hateful, but they were producing these ideas for our consumption to normalize existing racial disparities, to defend racist policies. We understand that, for instance, during slavery, slave owners would create and produce and defend ideas that black people were by nature slaves in order to justify the enslavement of their, you know, of people.
Of whom they were economically benefiting from.
Precisely. And so in many cases, they didn't even believe the ideas, the racist ideas that they were putting out there for our consumption. So you had slave owners who would say black people are stupid, but then they would, when one of their skilled slaves would run away, they would put out listings for that fugitive saying, my smart slave ran away, right? And so, you know, this continued to sort of happen in which people were producing these ideas to defend existing racist policies like slavery, like segregation, or even now like mass incarceration, in order to get us to not see slavery or segregation or mass incarceration as abnormal, because we were then led to believe that black people should be enslaved or black people should be segregated in those other neighborhoods, or black people are scary criminals that should be incarcerated.
And also, I mean, it's even systems that we have that we look at every day and we enjoy on television, like college football. You know, when you look at the bulk of the players, African-Americans, and they're not getting any benefit from their playing as student athletes. They're being deprived of an education, not actually given one. And then the system is making billions of dollars off of their talents.
Yeah, I think that's one of the ironies of the of Texas. It's one of the ironies of where I live in Florida, in which you have these major athletic programs like the University of Texas or even like University of Florida, which is of course based on the skills and labor of primarily black college athletes. And when you look at the actual percentages of black faculty or students at these very schools, they're underrepresented. But in the athletic teams, they're overrepresented. And the irony is that these institutions across the South are able to create these massive recruiting bodies that goes out there and recruit these players, right, while they simultaneously can't do the same things for students and faculty. And then the resources of those, the sort of byproduct of those millions and billions of dollars that are made by these athletic programs do not go back to those poor, oftentimes poor black communities where these athletes came from. They only recycle within the very politicians and the class of people who actually are not doing some of the things that are in the best interest of black people or even all working class people. Or even people of color in these states.
We're talking about the history of racist ideas in America. We're speaking with Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, and he is a professor of African-American history at the University of Florida. His book is Stamped from the Beginning. When we come back from the break, we'll start taking calls. You're invited to call in. The number is 210-614-8980. Can America actually become a colorblind society? What is holding us back? And is it the way that we have compiled our history? What do we need to remember in our history? What do we need to rethink, to reconsider? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Young black males are 21 times more likely to be killed by a police officer than their own white counterparts between 2010 and 2012. Federal data shows that the median wealth of white households is a staggering 13 times the median wealth of black households, and that black people are 5 times more likely to be incarcerated than whites. Black people make up 13.2% of the United States population. That means black people should make up about, you know, close to 13% of Americans in all sorts of fields, whether it be from, you know, in the Senate to people sitting in prisons. Why is this disparity? Why this is not jive? What is happening here? We're talking about the history of racist ideas in America with Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, and he is the author of Stamped from the Beginning. And so, Professor, why is it that they're 21 times more likely to be killed, an African-American male, than a white counterpart in America?
racial discrimination. And
But an officer doesn't say, he's a black guy, I'm going to shoot him. I can do that. No one's going to, you know, I can get away with it. You know, yay for me. I mean, is it more complicated than that?
Well, I think one of the, what has made it complicated, because on some level it is complicated, since the 1960s, or I should more say the 1950s, is that, yes, that officer is not going to say, I purposefully shot that black person because I was scared of them because they were black, right? They're not going to say that. They're smart enough to not say that. Their defenders are smart enough to not say that. But when we look at these disparities, these racial disparities that you just mentioned, black people being black, young black males were 22 times more likely to be killed by police than young white males. There's only two explanations for that. Either those young black males are acting 22 times more recklessly with the police, or it's the case that the police are acting 22 times more recklessly with black potential suspects than whites. And then you have some people who argue both. And so really over the course of American history, you've had these disparities between the races, whether it relates to police shootings or even, as you mentioned, wealth or even unemployment. And typically there are three positions that people make. A, that there's something wrong with black people, that black people are reckless, black people are lazy, black people don't do this or that. Others have argued that, no, there's something wrong with racial discrimination. And then you've had certain people who've argued sort of both. And those right. three positions have really argued over the course of American history.
I'm going to take these calls in just a second, but I want to follow up with this. Can it be true that these are all interconnecting systems that work to prevent opportunity and improvement in lifestyle or for African-American men and women? And so when it finally comes down to an exchange between a police officer and an African-American young man, it's not just that interchange, it's generations of systems that have prevented the accumulation of wealth and education and status and self-esteem.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. And even the racist ideas that that officer, as a result of those generations of different opportunities, may have. And what I mean by that is, and these are racist ideas that many of us have, that if we were honest with ourselves, we would admit. And when I say many of us, I'm talking about myself too. The idea, for instance, that black communities are more dangerous than white communities. You know, that's a widespread idea. But when we actually look at the statistics, when we look at the actual crime statistics, not the arrest data, not the incarceration data, we find that, for instance, white people are more likely to sell and consume drugs than blacks, even though the majority of people who are arrested in this country are arrested for drug crimes and incarcerated for drug crimes. We find there's a direct correlation between unemployment and violence, which means that there's a such thing as an unemployed dangerous neighborhood, but there's not such thing as a violent black neighborhood. And what I mean by that is across the racial groups, you have an increase in unemployment, you'll have an increase in violent crime. But right. Of course, we're not calling for a war on unemployment to reduce violent crime. You know, it's also sort of the ideas that we have that have constantly been produced that we've consumed that causes us to think black people are criminals, that causes right. us to think their neighborhoods are dangerous.
Just to amend what you're saying, now that we're seeing heroin becoming a white problem, we're seeing all sorts of laws and harm reduction and ways to trying to be nicer and kinder to drug addicts. But when it was a black problem, it's just the opposite. I'm going to take a call right here. Mary's on the line. Hi, Mary. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am a mestiza Latina, and I wanted to share the fact that I'm very proud that my family at my generation level has started to write about our history. And just like the word history, if we split it in half, it's his history. And as Latinos, we have been left out of the bulk of the American history, and I'm coming to find out that I'm a native of this country when I go into the Coahuiltecan population and the Apache, and it's very interesting. And we have been right in the smack in the middle of Jim Crow, and we built the missions, and it goes on and on and on.
Absolutely, Mary. Thank you for your call. Appreciate that. You do cover that some in your book. Dr. Kendi, you mentioned the Spanish missionaries and the racism behind the Mexican-American War, but you're definitely focusing on African-American issues.
Yeah, so my book focused on anti-Black racist ideas, but clearly, you know, racist ideas have not just targeted Black people in this country. Racist ideas have targeted Latinos and Chicanos and Native Americans and Asians. And even, ideas of inferiority have targeted certain white ethnic groups, all to justify the disparities between Chicanos and whites. Okay, so it's not that, you know, it's not that people are being discriminated against. It's that something is wrong with these people, right? And so Black people haven't been the only ones that, of course, have experienced that. Many different groups of people in this country have.
In Texas in the 1930s till 1944, we had the whites-only primary system, which was supported by the U.S. Supreme Court, and that discriminated against Mexican-Americans and Blacks equally. Let's get Sinclair on the air. And Sinclair, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, I've noticed, especially in this younger generation, my son's generation in college, they're accepting each other as far as dating and marrying and relationships, no problem whatsoever. However, the vocabulary and the language is so derogatory on any spectrum. I mean, I don't really care what color they are. With the Internet so available and access so available, why has the whole language or culture slipped down in speech, although in relationships and dating, they seem to be much more open?
All right. Interesting point, Sinclair. Thank you so much for calling in. So do you see that the younger generation, Dr. Kendi, is more open towards, becoming a colorblind society?
So, yeah, and I think that's one of the elements of racial progress that I was referring to sort of earlier. But I think she also mentioned the other side of the coin, which is the progression sort of racism, the ways in which people, while they're accepting of people, in certain ways they're still using old derogatory terms to understand and even to communicate with those very people that they're accepting in their communities or in their lives or in their spaces. And so you have sort of both going on at the same time.
But what speaks louder, you know, the language, of course, it's important, but if you say all the right words, but still you're, you know, behind closed doors, you won't hire that guy because he's not the right color, or you won't date that person or what have you, isn't it more important to be able to, you know, get past the actions and start accepting people for on the quality of their character, not the color of their skin?
Exactly, and that's why I am razor focused as a scholar on racial disparities, because to me, true progress in a total sense will see the decline in disparities, right? And that's not just in terms of Blacks and whites. That's really all groups. You know, we'll see this decline in disparities, because what will happen is if there's a decline in disparities, that means there's a decline in discrimination. That means there's more equal opportunity, and that because I truly believe the racial groups are equal, then you'll have equal advances, you know, with the groups.
Absolutely. Okay, Ricardo has called in. Ricardo, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My comment question is, don't you think most of this, while I accept that a lot of it has to do with racism, don't you think most of this really has to do with poverty, that I'm Hispanic, but I'm a professional and well off, and I don't encounter racism nearly in the level that others who don't have the advantages that I have do, and isn't that the same for African Americans and across the board? That really economics is what has to do more than race here.
Okay.
I'd love to hear your comments on that,
Ricardo. Thank you for the call. So I think that's the intersection between classism and racism.
Yeah. So I mean, Ricardo, I mean, I'm happy he mentioned class, and I try to talk about that intersection. Because I think, of course, we've long had a debate, especially between people who understand class and poverty issues and people who understand racial and racial issues. And I think the problem is we've tried to argue which one is sort of more important instead of recognizing that they're both equally important and they intersect for poor black people. And they intersect because they're poor, which is the class side of it, and they're black, which is the racial side of it. So because they're poor, they get exploited as poor people do, but because they're black, they get discriminated against as black people do. And so that class racism is sort of both. And I'll also add that
I'm running out of time, so I'm sorry I had to cut you off, but it was really great to have you on. Fascinating book. It was great talking with you, Dr. Kendi. The name of the book is Stamped from the Beginning: The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. This is The Source on KSTX.